sober and free from all mind-altering, mood-altering, emotional-altering chemicals since Halloween 1978. And that's a miracle. Really good. I got to thank Larry for hosting me this weekend and picking me up at the airport. It's been a good weekend. I'm too young to be in the long-timer group. I mean, sitting over there in God's waiting room, I felt like I was the only one there with my original teeth. Well, now that I've alienated half the room, I belong to a group that has a lot of people that are sober over 40 years. And if it wasn't for the people that went before me, there would be no message of Alcoholics Anonymous for a guy like me when I got here. And I got here because I was dying of alcoholism. I didn't get here because I had a drinking problem. I didn't get here, and I'm not a member of Alcoholics Anonymous because of the membership requirement in the short form of the third tradition. To be honest with you, I didn't have a desire not to drink. But I got here and I've stayed here for almost 24 years because of the membership requirement in the long form of the traditions, where it says membership should include all who suffer from alcoholism. And I didn't know what was wrong with me, but I suffered. And I suffered just as much when I stopped drinking, probably more than when I was drinking. I shouldn't be an alcoholic. I didn't come from an alcoholic home. I never saw anybody drunk or even drinking that I can remember growing up. I came from a family that loved me, that cared about me. I always knew they were on my side, and I always knew intellectually that they loved me, but there was something about me, even as a young kid, that I couldn't feel it. I was that internally focused and self-absorbed, even as a child, that I could not feel the love in my family that my sister felt, but I was so wrapped up in me and so disconnected from the external environment even back then. I look back over my childhood, and really the only thing I remember with any clarity is me. I remember all about me. I remember anything that had to do with me. I can't tell you what my mom and dad and sister struggled with unless it had to do with me. And I was the center of the universe even as a young kid. Tell you a little story. One Sunday afternoon, I went with my folks to an outing that we used to go on a lot of stuff. And we were coming back home, and my dad wanted to stop at this farmer's market. And we're going in there because he wants to get this horseradish that is hotter and more powerful than any other horseradish. It won all these awards. And my dad, to him, hot, spicy stuff was like his alcohol. I remember him as a little kid watching him sit with a bowl of those jalapeno peppers and watch him eat them until the sweat would just pour off him and his eyes would glaze over. And he'd make noises like he was having sex or something, you know, like just like, oh, you know, eating these peppers. And he just loved stuff like that. That was his alcohol. And we're going in there to get this horseradish, and I'm hearing him brag to my mom about how powerful it is. And I'm 3, maybe 4 years old at the most, and I don't even know what horseradish is, but I'm hearing the commercial, so I want some. So I said, Papa, can I have some? And he said to me, he said, Rob, you can't have any. It's too strong, too powerful. It's only for adults. You can't have any. Well, there's something about me. I don't know what it is. I may not really want something until you tell me I can't have it. To this day, I can barely make it by a do not touch wet paint sign without going like that. I don't know what it is about me. It's just like that. And I waited till my folks weren't around. I snuck in that kitchen. I got that jar of horseradish, got a big spoon, sat on the floor of that kitchen, put that spoon in that horseradish, stuck it in my mouth, and I think I saw God that morning. I'm not sure. Snot's pouring out of my nose. Tears are running down my face. I spit horseradish all over that damn kitchen. Sick, 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 sick. That was over 40 years ago. I have not once sat with a jar of horseradish, big spoon, didn't need a sponsor, no steps, no meetings, no nothing. But if you're new, I want you to hear this. If that horseradish would have done for me what alcohol did for me, I'd have spent the rest of my life making myself sick with that crap every chance I can get. Because I was born with a soul sickness that our book calls a spiritual illness. I was born with sickness of my heart that I never knew I had. Dr. Silkworth says to us, our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And I just seemed to adjust growing up to a kid as a kid to being with this sense of disconnectedness and not quite fit, and almost as if that was normal. And the disease of alcoholism was touched by alcohol in me for the first time when I was 12 years old. And I was hanging around with a bunch of older kids. I wanted to fit with them, didn't feel like I fit with them, but I wanted to fit with them. And I wanted to fit with them because they were the juvenile delinquents of the town I lived in. They were the kids that they were a little older than I was, and they were tough, and they were always in trouble. And they looked like like nothing bothered them, and everything bothered me. I was anxious and uptight and afraid of all kinds of things. And I thought if I could fit with these guys, maybe I would feel like they look. And so I'm stealing and smoking cigarettes and fighting and doing anything I can to fit with these guys. And one day we pulled a little burglary in our neighborhood, and one of the things we stole was some bottles of whiskey. And I never forget the 7 on the label. It was a bottle of Seagram 7. We were passing this quart bottle around, and I took the first drink I ever took. Didn't know nothing about alcohol, didn't expect anything, didn't even expect a high. I didn't really know what to expect. I just wanted to fit with these guys. And I'd pretty much done anything to belong. And I got to tell you something. When the burning stopped, I felt so good that the way I was from that moment on without it was never enough again. And I lived for it. And when you're 12, 13, 14, 15 years old, you can't drink every day, but I drank every chance I could get. I'm the guy that Dr. Silkworth talks about when he says, guys like me, one of the things that differentiates me from a non-alcoholic is I have an allergy to alcohol. And unlike some allergies where you break out in hives, when I drink, I don't break out in hives. I break out in what Silkworth calls a phenomenon of craving. Now, I didn't know I had that because he also says to us our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. I didn't know I had a craving. I got to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in an institution in 1971. And I used to hear occasionally people in AA meetings talk about this craving for alcohol, and it doesn't apply to me. I mean, I drink and I get drunk, but it's not a craving. I mean, it's just everybody I drink with drinks like that. It's not a craving. I could look at my drinking and I could see no signs of a craving. But the funny thing about a craving is you don't realize you have it until it's interrupted. And one of the reasons I couldn't see the phenomenon of craving in me is that I somehow intuitively kept myself out of situations where I only had 2 or 3 drinks and could not get any more. Now, I don't do that because I think I'm an alcoholic. It's just an intuitive deal with me. I remember one time in junior high school, guys' parents were gone for the day, and a bunch of guys were over there watching a game on TV, and this guy pulls out a 6-pack of beer, and there's like 3 guys there. I passed. Now, I don't know why. I know if he'd have had 3 cases, I'd have been with him. But I just knew that if I had got 2 and couldn't get any more, it was going to be a bad day. Bad day. And yet I couldn't see that because I kept myself out of those situations. Probably in the mid-70s, I'm sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm listening to a woman share her experience with this disease, and I finally got it. I heard her talk about something that had happened to her at a dinner party. And all of a sudden, I remembered something that had happened to me when I was 18 years old. And for the first time, I could see the phenomenon of craving, and I became a little closer to becoming one of you. And what I remembered when I was 18 years old, I was dating a gal, and she invited me over to her parents' house for dinner. And it was going to be one of those meet the family all night deals, which I don't never like that stuff. I've always been self-conscious, don't like people looking at me. But I went trying to be a good guy, felt like I'm under the microscope, and I'm sitting down at the dinner table and they bring out a bottle of wine. Now, it's not the kind of bottle of wine that we would have bought. It was just a little bottle of wine. And they open this bottle of wine, they pour everybody a drink, and I've always drank quickly. I don't know if evaporation's a childhood issue with me or what, but I drink quickly. And because I drink quickly, I've killed two glasses out of that bottle of wine. They're still sipping on the first glass, and the bottle's dead. So I'm sitting there. I don't know about alcoholism. Matter of fact, if you could have put me on a lie detector at that moment and said to me, Bob, is there any way in the world you might be an alcoholic? I would have said, absolutely not, and the lie detector would have said I was telling the truth. I was going through my long-haired, better living through chemistry phase of my alcoholism. But alcoholism doesn't care if you do other drugs. It doesn't care what war you're protesting. It doesn't care even if you believe you got it. If you got it, you got it, even if you don't believe it. And I had it, and I would have bet anything I didn't. And I'm sitting at that dinner table, and I got two glasses of wine in me, and I'm going nuts. And I finally said to him, I said, God, that's good wine. Do you have any more? And they said, no, Bob. And they went back to talking, and I'm sitting there, and you know how you talk to yourself in your head? It's getting panicky in there. It's getting spinning. My head's spinning all this crazy stuff. I finally blurted out. I said, sure like beer. And they said, well, we don't have any beer, Bob. We don't have anything. We didn't know. Next time you come over, we'll get you a six-pack of beer. And they went back to talking about Vietnam and sports and all this crap. And I'm sitting there with two glasses of wine in me, and I think I'm going to lose my damn mind. And I don't know what's wrong with me, but I'm just nuts. And I finally excused myself from the table. I went to the bathroom, locked the door, and rummaged like a maniac through all their cabinets until I found a bottle of cough medicine that was 35% alcohol with codeine and turpinhydrate, which is a bonus. Sat on the edge of their bathtub and chugged that bottle of cough medicine down, and all the voices in my head just kind of slowed down and got focused, and they all lined up behind the same idea of let's come up with a story to get out of here. And I went back out to that dinner table, and now I could think straight. And I gave him a story about this thing I forgot to take care of. And I went and I got in my car and I drove down their street 20, 25 miles an hour like you're supposed to. Turned the corner and drove like a maniac 70, 80 miles an hour to get to a friend of mine's house who had an open bar in his basement because I had two glasses of wine. And that's the phenomenon of craving. And I was the only person at that dinner table that was alcoholic. Those other people been alcoholic. We'd all been in that bathroom looking through those cabinets. But something happens to me when I drink that doesn't happen to non-alcoholics. And I'll tell you something. It took me a long time to understand that. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous the last time in 1978. And by this time, I couldn't have said the words phenomenon of craving, physical allergy. But I knew from painful, bitter experience that I was the guy that you people talked about. That if I took a drink, I couldn't stop. I knew I was that. And I came into meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I stayed sober. But I stayed sober secretly suspecting that everybody who drinks gets that craving effect that I get. I just thought that people who don't get in trouble are able to control it, and guys like me were weak-willed or something, and we can't. I mean, why would I think anything else? For me to think that alcohol affects other people differently than it affects me would be like thinking to yourself that strawberries taste different to you than they do to other people. It would never occur to me. So I just suspected that everybody, when they drink, gets that feel, that warm feeling of, whoa, yeah. You know, and I... Silkworth says that's not true. He says those other people never, ever get that. And I didn't understand that till for a long time. I got a job when I was almost a year sober, working as a cashier in a store. One of the things they sold in there was alcohol. And I would see things in there that were just amazing to me. I mean, I remember watching these two construction workers come in Friday after work for their weekend. They were roommates. And they bought a six-pack of beer for both of them for the weekend. You know what I thought? I thought they were showing off. You know, like flexing their willpower muscles in front of me. Like as if it was... Silkworth says they're not doing that. It's not even a deal with them. And I didn't get that till I was about 4 or 4.5 years sober. And I finally had an experience that I understood what Silkworth meant, Dr. Silkworth meant. I was dating a girl that wasn't an alcoholic. And we'd go out to dinner and she'd order a drink, which was okay with me. But it would take her a half hour to drink one drink. I mean, I could sit there and watch the ice melt, which is alcohol abuse, if you know what I mean. She'd stir. Talk, 10 minutes, forget the drinks here. You ever forgot your drinks here? I know where my drink is. I know where your drink is. I know where the bartender is. It was almost as if it wasn't even there. And I asked her one time, I said, were you ever drunk? And she said, yeah, one time in college. It was awful. I'd never do that again. I was at her apartment one time. She brings out this glass case with this marijuana cigarette in it, and she tells me that this guy a month before had given her this marijuana cigarette from Thailand, and she'd taken two hits off of it, and she was saving the rest for New Year's Eve. I mean, how do you know you're going to live that long, you know? That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. I never saw her drunk. I never even saw her have more than two drinks. On two occasions that I can remember, once at a cocktail party for where she worked, and another time at one of those French restaurants where you're there for a long time, I saw her get two drinks. But she never even finished the second drink. She'd get about halfway through it and do the most bizarre thing you've ever seen. She'd push it aside. She'd say, I don't want any more. I'm starting to feel it. Be easier for me as an alcoholic to have sex and after two strokes say, I don't want any more of that. I'm starting to feel it. Going to do that with two drinks of alcohol. So I started to understand by contrast of experience what Silkworth is talking about when he says that this phenomenon of craving differentiates us and sets us apart as a distinct entity. It never, ever occurs in the average temperate drinker. These people that I would see drink successfully, it took no willpower on their part at all. You see, when they take two drinks, they get a feeling like they're losing control. And it's distasteful to them. I take two drinks and I get a feeling like I'm getting control, and I can never get enough control. And I want more, more. I've never had the experience that the Al-Anons have, non-alcoholics have all the time. Been drinking for an hour or so, been in a bar, have the bartender come by and say, Bob, want another drink? Sit there like a non-alcoholic and go, no, this is just right. Oh, it's never been just right. Never once. Now, it's about to be. On the next drink, I always had this sense that I'm about to be there. And I think that's one of the reasons I drank with a sense of urgency, because I had this feeling, maybe on the next drink, man, I'm going to be there. Never got there. If you're sitting here and you're new, there's a... You're not sure if you're an alcoholic or if you have this phenomenon of craving. There's a test in the big book. It's in the book. It's in chapter 3, more about alcoholism. I don't know if it's a good test. I don't recommend it to people. The test is to go to a nearest barroom, try some controlled drinking, try to drink, stop abruptly. I'd be afraid to recommend that test to you. Your sponsor may want to take that on his shoulders. I'd be afraid the phenomenon of craving, unbeknownst to you, would be so powerful in you that you couldn't stop and you'd get in your car and kill yourself or somebody else, and I'd feel bad for recommending it. And besides, I don't think it's a viable test for an alcoholic of my type, really. I mean, when you think about it, okay, I'm going to take the test. I'm going to go into this bar. I'm going to have two, That's it. Don't smoke nothing, take nothing, just two drinks, that's it, go home. Well, about halfway through that second drink, it became real clear to me that this is not a good test day. It's a good test, but Jim just walked in. I got to have a drink with Jim, and there's some blonde over there. Got to have a drink with her. Bad test day. Tomorrow would be a better test day. And it would always be tomorrow. Because something happens to me when I start drinking. It's like a key turns in my head. And my ability to minimize, rationalize, and justify always gets right behind whatever is necessary to satisfy that craving. And I think this is the only disease I know of that if you got it, it uses your own mind against you. That's why there's no chapter in the book into thinking. Matter of fact, the whole essence and thrust of Alcoholics Anonymous is get away from thinking. I love to watch people sober a number of years talk about working on themselves. Oh, get away from yourself. Don't do that. That's bad. Don't work on yourself. Devote yourself to helping others, cleaning house and making amends, and maybe God will work on you in the meantime. I started coming in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous throughout the early 70s, and I could finally buy that I shouldn't drink, that I was an alcoholic. I think, at least I thought I was. I don't know, really, looking back, that I really knew what it was to have alcoholism. I knew that drinking was killing me, and I knew I had to stop. But I didn't understand what was really behind all this. And it's taken a lot of years in sobriety just to start to get a glimpse of the disease of alcoholism. What an insidious disease it is. And I remember sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous beaten and wanting a way out and wanting something different and sitting there and observing you. And what I observed made no sense to me at all. I observed people who quit drinking and they became better. They quit drinking and they had great relationships. They had success in their life. They laughed a lot. They were external people. Most of the people I saw in AA on a good day in my early drinking would have taken me a pint of whiskey to be like that. And I came to the conclusion that you people stopped drinking and you got better. And I had a secret. And my secret is that I stopped drinking and I really got worse. And I didn't understand what was wrong with me. But I'm the guy that when I quit drinking, I'm prone to deep, deep depressions. I become so filled with anxiety that sometimes it borders on panic. I don't fit anywhere. I become so lonely that it hurts. And I'm talking about that kind of loneliness where you're surrounded by people and some of them are reaching out to you, but it seems almost as if there's an invisible yet impenetrable barrier between me and you, something I cannot surmount or break through. And the only thing I've ever known in my life that let me break through that barrier was in the early days of my drinking when it really worked, and 5 or 6 drinks and I could come out and play. 5 or 6 drinks and I could be connected to you the way I always observed that you seemed to be connected to each other. And in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, in A Vision for You, it says that we get to a place where we know a loneliness such as few do. And as unfortunately, alcoholism, the book says it's a progressive disease. And what that really means to me, it's a disease of diminishing returns. When I started drinking as a young kid, there was a tremendous amount of fun about it. A tremendous effect. In essence, alcohol really treated the spiritual malady of alcoholism. It was a dynamic treatment for this soul sickness I have. And we all know what that's like. I mean, if you're a real alcoholic, that's why I drank and drank even past the point where it worked anymore, desperately hoping to jumpstart the old thing in me. Because when it worked, it was magnificent. I remember times walking into bars or parties or places and being so sick of heart, so locked up inside of me that I can't even talk to anybody. and have 5 or 6 drinks and I could come out and play. 5 or 6 drinks and I could connect with people. 7 or 8 drinks and I could look around and realize I love everybody. Now that is a vitalization of my spirit. Because before I picked up that first drink, I was sick of spirit. I was disconnected. But as the years went on, my ability to achieve that effect from alcohol got less and less, and the problems got more and more and more. And the problems got to the point where they became overwhelming. There's a part that Silkworth talks about where he says, our problems pile up on us and become astonishingly difficult to solve. And a friend of mine has a great analogy, and I think it's really accurate for a guy like me. When you're a practicing alcoholic, it's almost like you're living in a station wagon, driving around, partying, and as problems come up, traffic tickets, too busy, throw it in the back of the station wagon. Funerals, can't grieve them, can't even go show up, I'm too busy partying, throw it in the back of the station wagon. Birthdays, wish I could go, but I can't, busy, throw it in the back of the station wagon. Warrants, throw them in the back of the station wagon. IRS, throw it in the back of the station wagon. On and on and on. And then getting sober is like running the station wagon into a brick wall, and out of the back in slow motion comes all this crap. And you find yourself in Alcoholics Anonymous and you're 30 days sober and just enough for the fog to lift, and you're up to here and you're going crazy. And people are saying, if you just don't drink, it'll be okay. And you're going, but look at this. Look at all this. Yeah, but just don't drink and work the steps. The steps. I need a lawyer. Look at this. The steps. And yet, the funniest thing happened to me. In 1978, I'll skip around. I'm skipping around a little bit. 1978, coming off my last run, I was faced with so many problems. I was faced with a couple years in prison. I'd been homeless for a couple years. I did so much damage to everybody who ever loved me. I was totally alone. And I told a guy all this stuff. And he said to me, he said, Bob, if you'll just make Alcoholics Anonymous the center of your life, and put as much time and energy into AA as you used to put into trying to stay drunk and run the universe to suit yourself. If you put AA in the position in your consciousness that once was held by the bottle, all this stuff will take care of itself. And when Joe said that to me in 1978, I just said, okay, what do I got to lose? I don't know how I'm going to stay out of prison. I don't know how I'm ever going to get a job. I don't know how I'm ever going to repair the unrepairable damage I did to a mother and father whose biggest crime was that they loved me. I don't know how I'm ever going to change any of this. And so it was my day of commitment. But what brought me to that place, and because I'd spent years around Alcoholics Anonymous, sitting in the rooms of AA dying of alcoholism, what brought me to a place where I was willing to get out of the group it talks about in chapter 5? The group of people, and there's some of them in this room tonight, the ones that are dying of alcoholism and will die of alcoholism. And I was part of the group it talks about. It says, those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. I've been part of that group for 7 years. And what happened to me in 1977... I know what it's like to be thirsty. In 1977, I was in a halfway house. And I'd been in there, and I was sober like several months. I was sober as long as I could stand it. And I'm one of those kind of guys that abstinence feels like I'm doing time. And I can say no, but I can only say no for a little while. It's like, no, no, no. I said no. No, thank you. No one will smoke nothing. No, 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 no. Okay. And an alcoholic of my type with untreated alcoholism, there's a yes in every barrel of no's. Sometimes it's the bottom, sometimes it's the top, sometimes it's the middle. But if you're an alcoholic of my type and all you've done is stop drinking and go to a few meetings, I got to tell you, you can be throwing stuff at the beast to slow it down, but it's coming. It's coming. Because I have a disease that demands treatment one way or another. One way or another. And I'm one of those, I'm a short fuse alcoholic. Some guys can stop drinking physically without the benefit of any steps, without doing nothing, and stay physically dry for long periods of time. I have a friend who went 7 years before he got a sponsor who worked a step. I mean, he says it's the most miserable 7 years of his life, but he's like the John Wayne of alcoholism. I mean, that takes a tough guy to do 7 years. I was a short fuse guy. I'll tell you the guy I am. I saw this movie when I was a kid. And in this movie, the Russians had caught this American spy. And he's got these security secrets that he's trying to protect because it'll change the balance of power. And the Russians are determined to torture these secrets out of him. So they got him strapped naked to a chair, and they got these electrodes, and they're putting him on his private parts, and he's screaming and yelling and withering in pain. And they're doing this to him hour after hour, day after day. And finally, after a couple days, he breaks down and tells them everything they want to know. Well, I'll tell you the guy I am. I'm the guy you just show the wires to. Right? You just shut, and I'm giving it up. Now, I want to be the tough guy that I just don't drink no matter what, you know? But I ain't that guy. I've always been underneath. Now, there have been times in my life where I've carried guns, and there's a guy that was talking over dinner that I opened up his chest with a hunting knife and I still haven't made amends to. There was times in my life where I had the facade of a guy that was tough, but the real truth is inside me, where I really live, is just a scared, pathetic little boy. That's the truth. And I don't have what it takes to take intense emotional pain for long periods of time. I went to psychiatrists through those years, and I was honest with some of these guys. I went to some great psychiatrists, and they'd put me on meds because I was depressed. And I like pills. Oh, I never had anything against pills. But I tell you the problem with medication in a guy like me, and I have no opinion on other people. If they take it, that's fine with me. But I tell you what always happened to me is that if you give me a little bit of emotional relief, you open the door, and now I know more's there. And it's like a slow burn. Don't tease me like that. And every time you open that door to me, one of two things happens. I know that there's more relief, and eventually I'm going to go after something stronger. And also, you've taken just enough of the edge off of my desperation that I cannot ever break down enough to go get a sponsor and start following directions and become a part of here. And so I tried that for a number of years. I was in a lot of rehabs. I tried a lot of stuff. And I didn't understand what was wrong with me. And I keep ending up back in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings over and over and over again. In rooms full of people that quit drinking and they're happy. And I know whatever's wrong with me is not wrong with the same thing that's wrong with you. And I'm in this halfway house and I'm dry several months and I'm just ready to go, man. I can't take it anymore. And I call this guy up who I'd been in detox with, and I know he was back to drinking. And he had a little trailer in this next town over. And I call him up, and he said, "Oh, yeah, man, come on over. Can you get a weekend pass?" I said, "Yeah, I think I can get a weekend pass." He says, "I found this rock and roll bar." And he says, "I got some Thai stick, and I got these beautiful girls hang out there, and they got great bands." And I'm like drooling. Because I've been in this state of sober isolation in the middle of AA, lonely, dying here for several months, and I just can't take it anymore. And I want some relief. So I got a weekend pass. Going to go down here, spend the weekend with this guy. Got a plan. Plans are good. Newcomers should always have a plan. Here's what my plan is. I'm going to go down there, meet this guy, get drunk all Friday night, all day Saturday, Saturday night, Sunday morning, stop, sober up, get back to the halfway house so I don't lose my place to live. Things will be cool. I remember thinking to myself, vaguely, the thought went through my mind, well, what's the worst that can happen here? I mean, they could find out I was drinking, I get thrown out, maybe I can stay on my friend's couch, maybe I'll go down to the Hope Rescue Mission of the Salvation Army, done that before, not the end of the world. It seems like an acceptable price to pay for this relief I really, really need. I got to have some fun here. I've taken about as much sobriety as I can stand. And I went on this run, a victim of an illusion that it talks about in chapter 3, and it's this illusion is what kept me from getting a foothold here. And I work with a lot of new guys, and I see it. I think it stops a lot of us from ever getting all the way in here. The book says the illusion that somehow, someday, I'll control and enjoy my drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. Many pursue the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. And I tell you, it's not that when it's control and enjoy, it's what it is to me. It's not that I can drink and not pay a price. I know I'm going to pay a price. The illusion is that I have enough control to keep the price down to something I can live with. That's the illusion, right? It's an end that I can enjoy it and that it's going to be fun like it was fun when I was 20 years old. That's the illusion. Even though in the face of all evidence that it hasn't been fun like that or 2 or 3 years, I think it's going to be fun like that again. You know something? The last 3 years I drank, the best part of every drunk I ever went on was the hour before it started. Square business. That was the best it ever got. And then once I would start, and this drunk was like that, only I got it. I remember I'm sitting in this bar Friday night, and at that time I'm drinking 100 proof Southern Comfort, and I'm throwing beer backs, and I'm throwing down these double shots of 100 proof Southern Comfort, and I'm waiting for it to start. I'm waiting for the thing to jump start inside of me where I can come out of myself, I can go play with people, I can shoot pool, I can dance, I can talk to the girls, and all that's happening is that I'm sinking into oblivion. I'm in the midst of the phenomenon of craving, and I can't drink fast enough, and I can't jumpstart that thing inside of me. That thing that once relieved me of the bondage of self. That thing that happened to me in the early days of drinking where I could walk into a bar and be so locked up inside of me, and 5 drinks would relieve me of the bondage of self. Didn't work like that no more. Alcohol had stopped being a treatment for the spiritual malady of alcoholism. And I never wanted to believe that that was true. Because the deeper truth is, if the party's really over, what will become of me? Why would I even go on? Because this is a world that I've never really fit in. It's a world that I've never belonged in. And if the only thing that has ever worked for me and gave me an illusion of being a part of doesn't work, what am I going to do? And I started that run, and the next thing I know, it's Saturday night. We're coming back to his trailer. We had taken some pills and some stuff, and we were up all night drinking nonstop. And we go back to his trailer, and my friend goes in the bedroom to pass out. And I'm supposed to crash on the couch, but I'm still up. And I'll tell you the kind of drunk I am. I'm the kind of drunk that if I'm still conscious, I ain't done drinking. I'm that kind of alcoholic. I have to drink myself to sleep every single time. And he left his car keys and his wallet on the kitchen counter. But I'm not a thief, but I do know when a loan's appropriate. And I took a little money out of his wallet and took his car keys, and I went out. And I'm going out. I'm going to have a couple double shots and a couple beers, get a 6-pack of beer, come back to the trailer, put myself to sleep so I can get up tomorrow, get sober, go back to the halfway house. Next thing I know, it's Monday, and I'm coming to in a county jail, hit and run, DUI, and a stolen car. Unacceptable casualties. They gave me a phone call. I'll never forget this as long as I live. They gave me a phone call, and there wasn't a person on the face of the earth to call. I had destroyed my family. One of the worst things I did to my mom and dad is I kept getting up. Year after year, I'd get their hopes up. And they'd think their son, who they loved more than life itself, was going to be okay. And then I would steal from them or disappoint them or lie to them one more time. Until they couldn't even talk to me. They would not even answer the phone. It was just too painful. I had no more running partners. I had no girlfriends. I had no one to call. I couldn't get a date the last few years. It's hard to get a date when you're homeless. It's like, what do you want to do, baby? You want to come over to the halfway house and watch TV? I mean, it really cramps your love life when you're homeless. So I get this phone call. There's nobody to call. So I start calling bail bondsmen because I need a drink. I got to get out of there. But bail bondsmen want you to have like a job and an address. You know, I don't have any of that stuff. So I sat in that county jail for several months, went before a judge. He sentenced me to 2 years in a state penitentiary. When he said that, I thought I was going to just lose it. I don't want to do 2 years. I don't jail well. I can't imagine. I hate being in jail. I've been in jail a lot, and I hate it. I hate having to put on that gorilla outfit and act like a tough guy. I still got scars from county jail fights I've been in where you have to sucker punch some guy to show everybody you're not afraid when the truth is you're scared to death. I thought, I'll kill myself. I can't do 2 years of that. And this judge cut me a break, and he said, we're going to stay this commitment. And we're not going to carry it out. There's a place called the Ark House on the north side of Pittsburgh. It'll take you. It's the only place that will take you because I'd burn out all the other places. He said, if you'll go in there for 1 year, get good UAs, good PO report, make the restitution, you come back in front of me in about a year and we'll take a look at whether you got to do this 2 years or not. But if you cannot fulfill those requirements, you're done. You're gone. The commitment's already signed. So I went into this Ark House and I went in there with a desperation and a determination never to drink again. And I got to tell you that if determination and commitment was enough to overcome alcoholism, that would have been my sobriety date. But I'm the guy it talks about in the big book when it says lack of power. That is my dilemma. See, there comes a time when I have no effective mental defense against the first drink. There comes a time when even, no matter what's at stake, no matter how much evidence is at hand why I should not drink, the emotions and the emptiness of untreated alcoholism, no matter how great my resolve is to not drink, is those feelings gradually grind away that resolve until there's nothing left of me to resist the obsession to drink. And I'm in this place and I'm not drinking day in and day out and week in and week out and month in and month out, and I'm just getting it up to here. And I am so lonely and so depressed and I can't even take the meds because every time I do that I drink again. And I just feel like I can't stand it. And I'm getting ready to drink. And I'm at this in-house meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and there's a guy there who's in AA, and after the meeting, I did something that's hard for a guy like me to do. I grabbed a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I asked for help. And this guy lit up, and he sat down with me in the dining hall where that meeting was at the basement of this rehab. And I started to tell him about everything that was going on with me to the best of my ability. I told him about the 2 years in prison. I told him about the years of failure at trying to stay sober and how I was just starting to think about it, drinking all the time. I was just so screwed up. I couldn't work, and I tried to explain that to him. But there's something wrong with me. I get good jobs. I interview well. I just can't hold a job. I'm the guy that they're always calling into the office and saying things like, well, Bob, you're a hard worker, but we're going to let you go. There's something wrong with your attitude. And nobody explains that. What does that mean? Or the one guy, God, I had this great job, and they said, we're going to have to let you go because you're not a team player. And I thought, yeah, you're right. I don't know how to be different. Sober, I'm not a team player. Sober, I don't fit with these guys I work with. I want to, but I don't know how to fit. I don't know how to be a part of your team sober. Give me a pint of Jack Daniels, I'll lead your damn team. Sober, I don't feel like I can't mix with these guys. I don't know how to not be on the muscle around people when I'm up. I don't know how to not be uptight around people. I don't know how to not be withdrawn up into my head so far that I seem distant. And you interpret it as that I'm a snob or something, when I'm really just scared to death. And I'm telling this guy, I said, I got mental problems. I'm always getting in fights with people because I imagine they're saying or thinking things about me. You know, just wacko stuff. Some guy, if I say hi to somebody, he doesn't say hi to me. It's like, I know he hates me. He's talking about me. I'm going to get, you know, it's, I go crazy. I get a headache. I can feel a brain tumor growing. It's just, you know, voices in my head that just never, this chatter that never stops. You know, Bob, who do you think you are, Bob? What do you mean, that won't work. That won't work. People suggest, nah, you can't do that. It's all negative stuff. I'm crazy. I'm telling this guy all this stuff, and he says to me, he says, if you can put the 12 steps in your life, and he points to the thing on the wall with the 12 steps, and he says, I'll help you, and he gives me his business card. He says, all this stuff will take care of itself, and he gets up, and he walks to the back of the dining hall to get a cup of coffee, and I'm sitting there looking at these steps, and I had seen those steps. I'd seen them for almost 7 years in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous in different institutions. I knew what the steps read, but I thought to myself, well, let me read them again. And I started reading them again, and I thought, oh man, this guy has not heard a word I've told him. There's nothing in those steps that connects to my problems. Nothing. And it's not that I sat there. I didn't sit in AA and look at the steps and go, oh, they wouldn't work, or they're bad, or they're terrible, or I don't agree with them. I didn't think any of that stuff. It just didn't seem to apply to my particular unique problems. I mean, I thought they were a nice set of principles. Hey, if I ever got my life together, I might work the steps. I might join a gym too. Who knows? But I need a set of steps like step one, make Bob's police record disappear. Step two, make my family realize how wrong they'd been about me. Step three, give him $1,000. That would have helped my spiritual condition immensely. Or step four, bring her back, properly ashamed of herself. But instead you have stuff like turn your will and your life over to God. Oh, man, not that. Oh, I had a lot of religious upbringing. I knew about God. God existed to judge me. And he could see in the dark, which is not good for a guy. He could read my mind, which is hideous. It's like the brain police. And I remember the nuns used to say, you must be pure of thought, word, and deed. And I X-rated movies that go through my head. I remember one time sitting in class, daydreaming, like I always do. I think I had that ADD before it came out. Sitting there, daydreaming. Next thing I know, I'm imagining what this young nun looks like naked under her habit. And I catch myself and go, oh no, oh, I can feel the pitchforks coming at me. So, turn your will and your life over to God. I'd be better off with an attorney. I'm not God. Oh, man. And the step that made me insane, and it did even when I came back in after that last run, was step 8 and 9. I looked at those steps and amends. Oh, my God. Oh, if I had known I had to do that someday, I wouldn't have done any of that crap. Amen. And you guys, I could look at the people in AA and you should make amends. Yeah, you were nice people. I could tell by looking at you. And I'm sure you've done some things that were out of line. Maybe you got too drunk one night and said something nasty to your wife. You should apologize. Or maybe you padded your expense account. Yeah, go make it right. It'll build character. But I lived on the streets like an animal. There's a guy to this day I've never found that will never be the same because I took a hunting knife with a blade this long and I opened him up from here to here. And he almost died and he will never be the same. And I've hired detectives looking for him in my ninth step and I have never found him. There are people that went to prison as a result of me because I dimed him out to keep from going myself. There are people's lives who I just destroyed. A mother and father who loved me And I battered them emotionally over and over and over beyond the limits of human endurance until I broke their heart, until my mom, who doesn't have alcoholism, was taking sedatives and my daddy just slept all the time. Because the one person in life that he loved the most was dying and there was nothing he could do about it. How do you make amends to people like that? This guy comes back across the dining hall. I've been reading the 12 steps. I threw his card back on the table and I shuffled off to my bunk. You know, I knew that AA was nice, but it wasn't what I needed. And I'll tell you, my experience with Alcoholics Anonymous and being offered this process in these 12 steps was very similar to what would happen to any of us if we were to go down to the part of town that you live in where all the homeless guys are living in the bushes. And some little old man that's been in the bushes maybe for years comes up to you and he's dirty and he's got dirty matted hair and stuff in his beard. And he asks you for a quarter and you feel sorry for him and you give him a dollar. And he says, son, I like you. I'm going to give you $10 million. And he reaches inside his inner coat pocket and he pulls out a dirty, tattered check he's obviously stolen from somewhere and with a broken pencil writes out a check for $10 million and gives it to you. If you're like me, as you walk away, when you're out of sight, you know it's no good. You rip it up and you throw it away because the guy doesn't even have a quarter. Except that the check's good. And he's one of those nutcases like Howard Hughes. And for 7 years, you guys are giving me the check. And for 7 years, I'm tearing it up and throwing it away because it didn't make any sense to me. And if there's anything that would ever destroy a guy like me or keep me from getting everything that God would ever give his most beloved children, it is my judgment and my opinion that will keep me from never trying things and discounting this and making opinions about you so I never get to know you. And I started that last run and I tried to commit suicide on that run. I was in a stage of alcoholism that is bleak. And it's that stage of alcoholism where this all the fun is wrung out of it and you start drinking. And it's self-pitying and depressing. And I go on crying jags. And I put my hand into parking meters. And I've always gotten broken hands. And I've gotten cuts from falling. And I'm sick and rummy and full of self-pity drunk. And then I'm forced into a state of abstinence by getting arrested or going into a detox or running out of money. And abstinence is bleak and lonely and depressing till I can't stand it anymore. And I pick up a drink. And on and on and on. And I got to tell you something. If alcohol and all combinations of drugs and alcohol is painful and depressing, and abstinence is the same way, suicide starts looking like a good deal. And I stood on a bridge looking down on some railroad tracks about 100 feet below with a bottle of Richard's Wild Irish Rose. And I stood there trying to get up enough courage to just stop this. Just stop it. I don't want no more. But I'm a coward, and I'm afraid it might hurt. You know, and I can't even commit suicide. I'll tell you something. When you can't drink successfully, and you can't stay sober successfully, and you can't even kill yourself, what's left except the A&A? Right? They call it the last house on the block. There's a line in the Big Book, it describes exactly what happens to me. It said we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of our life as when we'd been living it. So when we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, that was you, finally there was nothing left but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools you'd been laying at my feet and I've been kicking out of the way for 7 years. And in 1978, running from the law, I ended up in a detox in Las Vegas, Nevada. I found my first sponsor there. He was part of a group of people that did H&I work. And I will always be grateful for the men and women who gave of their time and their attention to come into hospitals and institutions fishing for guys like me who were dying. And I met those people in there, and the Buddhists say when the student's ready, the teacher's appearing. And I started this journey. And I'm not going to talk a lot about the steps because I'm running out of time, but I am one who's, as the years go by, I've been whittled away into the kind of person that when I was new, I couldn't stand. An AA fundamentalist. And I'll tell you why, because I watch everything else that doesn't work, and this is what's left. I'm telling you, if crystals and all that other stuff worked, I'd be doing it. And this is what's left. And I started the process in these steps. I was brand new. I'm talking to a guy. He's trying to talk to me about step three, and I don't know. I don't know if there's a God or not. I'm praying because people in AA told me to get down on my knees in the morning at night, and I'm doing that. And I don't know if there's a God or not. I'm kind of afraid there is, and I'm kind of afraid there isn't. And this guy said to me, he says, you got to do step three. I says, I can't do step three. He says, why not? I says, I don't know if there's a God. He says, you don't have to believe in God to do step three. I said, it says God as you understand Him. I don't understand God. I don't know anything about it. He says, you know, in your case, he says, Bob, your case is different. You don't have to believe in God to do step three. I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, if you'll turn your will and your life over to this chair, I guarantee you an instant miracle. I said, okay, I turn my will and my life over to the chair. What's the miracle? He says, the miracle is your life's no longer in the hands of an idiot. I thought, yep, that'd be right. Yep. See, if you'd have followed me around from the time I was a little kid with a Polaroid camera and took a picture of me every time I was in trouble inside myself or outside myself, there's one thing in common in every picture, and it's not alcohol. The one thing in common in every picture is me. I am the source of all my problems. And I started that process in the fourth step, and if you're new here, if you've never done a fourth step, or maybe you've done the kind I did in the very beginning and had to come back and undo the life story guilt list, I got to tell you, when I finally did a fourth step, the way it's outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's nothing I've ever done here that has changed me more than that. When I was able to make a list of all the people I'd resented, and I looked at what was hurt, threatened, affected, or interfered with. And I had my case built on all of them. And then the book says, okay, you got to be free of these resentments. You got to, or it kills you. You can't wish them away any more than alcohol. What do? And it says, this was our course. You must realize how the person who had harmed you was perhaps like you. Spiritually sick, even though you didn't like their symptoms and the way they affected you, that they, like you, were sick too. Like me? You mean I got to see how I'm like these people that I hate? Oh, I don't want to be like them. I'm too busy. I get too much of a pump feeling superior to them. I don't want to. I got to see how if I was afraid, like they were afraid, if I was frustrated, drunk, stoned, if I'd been raised like they were raised, how I could have done the same thing to somebody else that they did to me? And as I went through my resentment list and did that, all of a sudden I started to see myself in these people. And when I started to see myself in these people, my view changed. And all of a sudden, for some of them, I started to even have a little compassion. And in some of the cases, I realized I'd done the same thing to some other people that they had done to me. And all of a sudden, the separation between me and them that had been created by my judgment started to dissolve. And then I was able to come back and for the first time in my life take the responsibility for the separation between me and them. And what a powerful... And I'll tell you the most amazing thing. When I looked at step five and I said the exact nature of my wrongs, I thought they were talking about the guy I stabbed and the money I stole. Well, that was all on my fear list because fear of getting caught, and it was all part of my eight-step list. But the real exact nature of my wrongs, what I was so wrong about, was my judgments. I was so wrong about my mom and dad. I was so wrong about all the women in my life. I was so wrong about the employers and everybody I thought that was out to get against me. I was so wrong about my fears to the point where I believed them so much that they locked me up, and I had a life full of things I would never try because I was so afraid of failing, or I was so afraid of not measuring up. I was wrong about a lot of stuff. And I started the sixth and seventh step. I skimmed over step six and seven. And I got to tell you, I think the story of my sobriety is the story of step six. How I've become entirely ready. And I'll tell you about me and my defects of character. They're all defense mechanisms that are defective. But I don't know that they're defective. I think they work. And I don't want to go to God with some of these things because I get a pump from them. There's a goodie involved in every single defective character. And what I found myself doing the first time I went through steps six and seven, I was going to God and I was asking Him to remove stuff, but I didn't really want Him to remove it. I wanted Him to remove the consequences. Right? But every defect of character has two parts. In Bill's story, he talks about going to his Creator and asking Him to remove these things, root and branch. See, I want to take away the branches that are poking me in the eye, but I want to keep the root because I get a sense of validation in the root. I mean, I want to be free of the sleeplessness and the discomfort of deep-seated resentment. But do I want to give up the pleasure of judgment? How would I make myself feel better on a bad spiritual hair day if I couldn't judge others? Or what if I went to God with lust and I asked Him to remove it and He really did? I mean, is that something Viagra could overcome? I mean, or if He took away my greed, would I still go to work? If He took away my anger, who would defend me? Maybe God would have to. Maybe I would actually be surrendered. In 1945, I think it was 1945, the Japanese Empire made an unconditional surrender to the armed forces. And they made an unconditional surrender because they didn't have a choice. They were facing, after two atomic explosions in major cities, they were facing obvious annihilation and extinction. They were out of alternatives. They'd gotten to a place where it says in our book, there was nothing left. And when they made this unconditional surrender, what they had to give up was all their ability to defend themselves. All their army, navy, air force, weapons. What would happen to me if I gave up my judgments and all the little props I used to validate myself? What would happen to me? Maybe what it talks about on page 53 would be true. When it says that God is either everything or He's nothing. He either is or He isn't. And it gives me a choice. It says, Bob, what's your choice to be? And I tell you, on a good day, God's everything. On a bad day, God who? One of the greatest things that happened as a result of making amends and realizing that I had so many amends to make that I could never make, that I had to give my life to service in Alcoholics Anonymous just to start squaring away some of the books for some of the people that I would never be able to find or know who they are. And I started sponsoring guys. And I'll tell you something. I've come to the conclusion, you know, I sponsor a lot of guys and I tell all of them. I said, we're going to go through these steps. But I don't care how good a job you do. As far as I'm concerned, your sobriety is precarious until you start sponsoring other people. And as the Hindus say, the student never learns a lesson until he becomes the teacher. And as a result of sponsoring guys and listening to Fifth Steps, the most amazing thing has happened. I have connected with myself in them over and over and over and over and over again. I've been waiting for years for a new Fifth Step. You know, I wish somebody would come up with something creative like, oh, a vibrating blonde rake and chunky peanut butter. Oh, great. You know, it's always the same thing over and over and over and over and over again. And maybe what Einstein says is true when he says the great illusion is that there's more than one of us here. The great illusion is that there's more than one of us here. And yet I lived a life of defending myself with my ego and creating states of separation and judgment and feeling superior and all the crap that I did between me and you. And I'm just separating me from me. There's a branch of Hinduism called Maya. It's the great illusion. And Maya, they have a story of creation that I love. It's unlike the Judeo-Christian story of creation that's in Genesis. And their story of creation is that God existed forever in timelessness. There wasn't even time. It was nothing but God. And after eons of timelessness, he got bored. And he decided to play a game with himself. And the game was he would split himself into an infinite number of parts, give all the parts amnesia, and the game was which parts are going to realize that they're not separate first. Which parts are going to claim their inheritance first? Which parts are going to realize that they're all part of the whole first? And through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and good sponsorship and making amends and helping other people that I find and discover that are just like me on this journey, I realize the great reality is that there really is only one of us here. And he's God's child. And I'd like to thank you for introducing me to him.